friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 126 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I am a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
Our mission on Dermasphere is to come to your ears every 2 weeks with discussions of some of the latest research in the world of clinical dermatology. We, of course, also have the Pimping Bell joining us. Say hello, Pimping Bell. The Pimping Bell exists to highlight especially question-worthy content, so pay attention. Also pay attention to... the Integrative Dermatology Symposium. They've become our friends here, and if you're ready to revolutionize your approach to dermatologic care, then allow me to introduce them. The Integrative Dermatology Symposium, or IDS, is a groundbreaking 4-day medical education conference that's redefining conventional limits. IDS is more than just an event. It's a transformative experience. Join the integrative dermatology community, fostering collaboration among healthcare professionals and bridging the gap between Western and Eastern modalities. Explore aging, wellness, and integrative aesthetics to develop a more comprehensive approach to patient care. IDS is all about embracing the power of collaboration in healthcare, infusing new ideas and treatment options into the discussion, and contributing to the evolution of whole person care, benefiting every patient. Mark your calendars now for IDS 2024 happening in Arlington, Texas, from September 26th to 29th. This is your chance to be part of the future of dermatological care. Early bird pricing ends on April 19th, and our listeners can use the code DERMASPHERE for 25% off their registration. That's DERMASPHERE. Check them out. They become friends of ours. Also, speaking of friends of ours, we've got a guest or two today. So I want to first introduce Dr. Amir Hussain. Dr. Hussain, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, can you start by introducing yourself?
Sure. So my name is Amir. I am a recent graduate of the Georgetown University Dermatology Residency Program. I went there for residency and for undergrad after a brief detour to University of Chicago for medical school. And I'm interested in contact dermatitis and medical education and health policy.
And Michelle, I'll let you introduce somebody else as well.
All right. We also have joining us today, student Dr. Ramla Khan, who is a fourth-year medical student who's applying for dermatology residency. And she's here to help us discuss some of the topics we're going to go over today.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being here.
So we want to talk here about culturally competent dermatology, and Amir, you've done a fair amount of work on this. There are at least four articles with your names on them about some of these issues, and in particular, we were going to discuss today one out of the Contact Dermatitis Journal called Allergic Contact Dermatitis Associated with Religious Practices, Review of the Literature. You're the first author, and the other authors are, I'll let you pronounce their name so I don't get it wrong.
Sure, that was Reva Khanna and Alan Moschel from Georgetown.
Wonderful. So tell us about this article and, I mean, any of your other work we'd love to hear you mention.
Sure. So I was actually a government major and a religion minor at Georgetown. And Georgetown is a Catholic Jesuit institution, and I'm a Muslim. So going there, I was kind of exposed to various different religious backgrounds. And as I got more interested in medicine, I was looking at ways to integrate these two interests. And going into dermatology, I realized that there's a lot of practices that people do kind of in their day-to-day life that impact their dermatologic care. And as I got more interested in contact dermatitis, I realized that it really becomes about taking a really good history, learning like everything you can about the patient, everything they've been doing. And a lot of them will be just doing these religious or cultural practices without realizing potentially these exposures are causing a contact dermatitis. And without learning that piece of that cultural practice, you're really not going to be able to identify what the practice is. And then secondly, once you've figured out what's causing it, you have to kind of navigate the discussion in a way that you have to explain that their practice is causing the dermatitis, but not blaming the patient for their condition. It's kind of like when someone has an occupational dermatosis, you have to let them keep practicing their job, but find a way around that. So when I was looking through the literature, I didn't really find much specifically on religious practices and dermatosis. So we did a literature review in PubMed, just looking at several of the world's major religions and looking at incidences of contact dermatitis. And that was kind of the background for the paper.
Very cool.
And it looks like you found a number of at least reported cases of allergic contact dermatitis that were associated with various religious and cultural practices from, a number of different religions, I guess I would say. There's Hinduism, Islam, and Judaism are mentioned because henna tattooing is a cultural practice, and I think we probably remember from residency that PPD, or paraphenylenediamine, can be used in some of these like temporary henna tattoos. And tell us what else is out there.
Sure. So yeah, PPD was by far the most commonly reported allergen. Some other ones were more of like a irritant contact dermatitis. So there's various components of Hindu religious practices, like bindis, like the red dots that people often wear on their forehead. Sometimes the adhesives that are used in these can cause a contact dermatitis, although you can't always determine the specific allergen. One thing I found very interesting was the tefillin. So these are leather straps that Orthodox Jewish patients may wear around their arms and sometimes around their forehead. And there are ways that you can kind of mitigate the contact dermatitis while still allowing them to practice their religion. And that was really something that we wanted to emphasize in this paper, is that after we identified a lot of the common allergens, what are some strategies that you can give patients that they can implement that they can still do the practice while having less of a dermatosis? So for example, for PPD, it's a common component of henna tattoos, but it's the actual henna plant is very rarely a cause of contact dermatitis. So you can have them look for henna tattoos that are free of PPD, and that can often help. And then for the tefillin, what you can do is sometimes use pre-treat the straps with vegetable oil, or if they've done patch testing and they have an allergen to potassium dichromate, which is a leather accelerator, you can find straps that are free of those substances. And there's similar guidelines for the other allergens, but definitely there needs to be more research done on this because, for example, we found only one or two articles on Buddhism and Sikhism and Islam, which are some of the most common religions in the whole world. So just trying to motivate people out there to do research or report these cases if you see it.
So how would you recommend, how would you recommend we approach a patient who we think has contact dermatitis, but we don't know what their religion is or what their cultural practices are? What's an appropriate way to discuss those issues?
Yeah, that's a great question. And with any kind of religious or cultural competency, you need to have a balance between treating the individual patient and not making generalizations about them, but also having a broad understanding of religions as a whole. So you at least have some familiarity. If they mention some practice, then you at least know like what's associated with it. So for example, if I had a patient that was applying substances on their forehead for religious reasons, I would ask them, okay, walk me through your day. Like you got up in the morning, what do you apply before going to work? And people will say, oh yeah, before going to work, I put this kind of sandalwood paste on my forehead and then I go out the door. And I'll be like, well, you have a pattern that is really consistent with contact derm on that specific area. And that might be a way we can start that conversation.
Sorry, Michelle, I stepped on what you were going to say a second ago.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think it's so important, like you're saying, that we don't remove the person from the practice. For example, like the Teflon strips, they're to remind people of like the golden calf and things, and also of very specific spiritual concepts. And so the production of those as a leather item from either a mammal of some kind or fowl is typically preferred. Do you have, besides the kind of oiling them with the vegetable oil, any other management techniques for that?
So the number one thing is going to be patch testing to find the specific allergen. So if there is a leather related allergen, there are ways that you can try to use alternative leathers. So maybe they don't have potassium dichromate, they might have other specific allergens. And then actually, when I was doing this project, I talked to an Orthodox rabbi, and she said that you can basically discuss with the patient individually with their own religious leader and say, how strict are they on the specific component of the straps? If they have to be from that specific leather or that specific fowl, then you may just want to treat through it like we do for occupational dermatosis, give them some steroids or calcineurin inhibitor whenever they use it. But if they're maybe not as strict on it, then you can find more creative ways to get around it. And I think that's important. Getting the community partners involved is very important for many of these patients. They really take a lot of guidance from their local religious leaders. And it's important to kind of bring them into the conversation so you can come up with a plan that really works for everybody.
You've also got a couple different articles published, it looks like, more specifically about things that go on in the Muslim world. So, for example, you've got an article called Prayer-Related Dermatoses in Muslims. Do you want to talk about that one as well? I found there were some interesting things there that I had no idea were happening.
Sure. And that was actually the reason we wrote this, is that I just noticed throughout my family, a lot of people have these prayer marks that you often get from repetitive pressure on the foreheads or the elbows or parts of the body that are contacting the ground during prayers. And for Muslims, this is just part of life. And a lot of people actually take pride in having these marks that show that they're very frequent in their prayers. But I have noticed that non-Muslims will see these and often get concerned that this is a inflammatory process. We need to do some significant investigation, biopsies, et cetera. And it's important for everyone to know that, you know, these are benign findings and you don't need to pursue this crazy invasive workup unless there's a specific reason to do it. And it was just I actually had a medical student that was very motivated. He took photos of himself praying and doing all the different positions so we could just document clearly what's exactly going on and how we can use that as a way to educate pretty much everybody who cares for Muslim patients about these findings.
And these, to my eyes, which are not Muslim eyes, they would look sort of like lichen simplex chronicus at various pressure points.
That's right. And that's basically all it is. And I think it's really important to just call it and name it that it's a benign finding we see all the time. It's an issue if it's kind of repetitive inflammation, that there actually are case reports of people growing SCCs within them, but they're pretty rare. And if people just have the kind of standard prayer marks, you don't even really have to comment on it. Or just if they ask about it, you can tell them this is what's happening.
You had a great article also about the examination of Muslim patients in the dermatological setting, specifically with attention toward female patients, because there are certain preclusions about uncovering parts of the body. And that article sort of spoke to my soul because I'm a big person about draping the patient. They're a human being, not a piece of meat. And I actually think if you drape the patient properly, it helps focus your exam, ensure patient comfort, and decrease distractions from other parts of the body. So I really like systematically examining the patient with draping to only examine the part that I'm looking at. You brought forward a model called talk before touch, and I'd love for you to elaborate on that.
Sure, and this was actually also driven by family members. So my mom actually has psoriasis, so she went to see a dermatologist who basically wasn't very careful with draping, and she felt like very exposed and basically didn't want to see a dermatologist ever again until I finished residency. So that... When I talked to other patients in my family, they basically all experienced the same thing. So I realized that when a patient comes into the office, they basically don't realize what we're exactly doing. We're looking at them and kind of seeing specific things. But if we're just like kind of staring at their entire body, they don't really know what we're doing. So when we drape the patient and say, talk before touch is, you know, I'm going to examine your arm. I'm going to examine your back. And, you know, I'm seeing this specific thing and calling out things as you're seeing them. I feel like that helps the patient participate in the exam. And if you can even say like, oh, this is a symmetric, benign looking mole, I don't think we need to do anything about it. Just kind of including them in that discussion and saying that I'm only really exposing places that I need to look at. And you can even have the patient do it for you. Like say like, oh, do you mind moving this part of your body this way? And then especially like as a man seeing Muslim women, I always ask them ahead of time, are you comfortable with me doing the exam? Would you prefer to see one of my female colleagues instead? A lot of times they'll be fine with it, but there's some people that do prefer a female doctor, and I will always accommodate that. So really, it's important to engage that dialogue with the patient to that make sure that as they're more comfortable they are, the more information they're going to give us, and that's going to help us find the right diagnosis.
Absolutely. I had the privilege of training at the Cleveland Clinic, and a number of our patients came from countries in the Middle East. And I also noticed that sometimes patients would have a translator with them, and even if the translator was the same gender, they might not be comfortable being uncovered in front of that person. And I'd like to bring you into the discussion too, Ramla. Do you have any like tips or thoughts around the exam of specifically female Muslim patients?
I think what Dr. Hussain brought up was excellent. The talk before touch method, I think that would help a lot. I think definitely kind of asking them ahead of time who's going to be in the room. A lot of times you have an MA, you might have a medical student, and it puts a lot of pressure when you walk in with this team and you're like, are you okay if we have everyone in here? They might feel forced to say yes, even if they're not very comfortable. So maybe having the MA kind of ahead of time ask. And I think sometimes they can even kind of go through what's going to kind of be going on today, and that might help them feel a little bit more comfortable just hearing it from multiple different people.
I think it's important for us to remember that what is routine for us is very much out of the ordinary for our patients. And I think that goes beyond religious and cultural issues as well. It's just, it's normal for us to be looking at naked bodies all day, but it's very not normal for a random person to have somebody look at their naked body closely. And important for us to recall that. Well, thanks for being here, Amir. We really appreciate it. If people are interested in learning more about you or your work, are you on the social medias or is it a PubMed search?
Sure. I mean, so my website is HusseinDerm.com, and you can find me on Instagram at ThePunisherMD because I'm a big fan of puns, as you are, Dr. Johnson. So yeah, thanks so much for being here. I'm really happy to kind of share any tips I have. People are welcome to message me if they have any questions about Islam or care for Muslim patients in general.
That's great. Well, thanks for being here and being a resource for our listeners. Amir will say goodbye to you, but Ramla will keep you around here so that we can give you the floor for some time. But Amir, we'll let you go.
Well, Ramla, we're so happy to have you with us today to provide perspective as a person who lives in the kind of narrative of being thoughtful about, you know, modesty and discussing the different cultural practices around the exam of patients who are Muslim.
Thank you for having me. I think this is a wonderful platform to kind of talk about some of this stuff.
That's wonderful. What would you like for people who are practicing dermatologists to know about the exam of a Muslim female patient, for example, or how to approach some of the areas that people might be a little bit uncomfortable in?
So yeah, just a lot of what I mentioned earlier. I think it's also helpful to kind of know a little bit about just terms and how to pronounce stuff. So like a lot of women wear a head covering. Sometimes it's referred to as a hijab, but it can also generally be referred to as the hijab, which refers more to just modesty and covering up a little bit and feeling secure in who you are. So instead of just telling somebody if you can remove that thing in your head or, you know, it'd be better if you knew how to pronounce it and knew how to verbalize just what you're trying to get them to move. Just talking before touch, I think that's such a wonderful idea. I had not heard of it before, but I think it would be so helpful across the spectrum, not just with Muslim patients.
I agree.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Also, I think it's the draping method. Sometimes it gets forgotten. Sometimes we get busy, we're rushing through clinic, and you know, we might forget, but it really does help patients feel more comfortable. And with patients who dress modestly and who are covered most of the time, I think it's very, very important to kind of keep that also in the clinic and in the patient rooms.
Absolutely. And this definitely extends beyond cultural practices to patients who have been through difficult experiences or people who are going through a unique journey. I'm on a safe providers list for victims of sexual assault, as well as for transgender and non-binary people. And being able to be respectful of a person's body during the exam, I think, is a very important thing to provide patient comfort and decrease anxiety.
My sense is that it goes a long way to just care and be respectful about it. I don't know, because I'm not on the receiving end of these things usually, but if I have patients who are wearing a, to help me if I'm pronouncing it right, hijab, I'll say, are you comfortable with me moving your head covering aside or something along those lines? And I hope that even if I fumble my way through some of the pronunciation and so on, that they at least appreciate that I don't just sort of barrel in there. And Ramla, can I ask you a question? Like, what about something? Sometimes I don't know what to do with something as what seems to me as simple as like a handshake. Because as a pediatric dermatologist, I'll often have children who are not wearing particularly traditional clothing, but their mothers might be. And I, should I say, are you comfortable with a handshake? Should I just sort of not do it and kind of nod at them politely? What's the right way to go about this?
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways. I think there's a spectrum of religiousness that kind of plays into this. For me, I would kind of just go in with a nod. If you see a woman who's wearing a hijab and they're modest and they're covered, as someone who's a male, usually the right thing to do is just nod and not shake their hand, because it can, a lot of times people will walk in and it's natural to offer that hand, to offer a handshake. And they might feel uncomfortable and you might have that little awkward moment. So if it was me in your situation, I would kind of forego that handshake and just say hello and walk in. I think especially with COVID, the handshakes have become less frequent, so it's not experienced as much. But I really don't think there's a right or wrong answer. Sometimes they'll just politely decline, and it would be nice if you would not be offended because it's nothing personal against you.
Wow, it's hard to offend me, but I just, you know, don't want my patients to feel uncomfortable.
No, I think just kind of walking in, saying hello, I think it goes a long way when you're just a genuine person and someone who's kind, and people pick up on that. So if you walk in and say hello and ask about their day, it's exactly the same as offering that handshake.
That's good. That's really good feedback. Do you have any other thoughts for us today, Rama?
I just think this is a wonderful platform. I think if people really want to learn more, we have this wonderful organization called AMSA, it's the American Medical Muslim Student Association. Dr. Hussein's actually a part of it too, but we started 2 years ago and we had our first conference in Michigan. And last year we had a conference in New York, and we kind of bring together Muslim students from across the nation. We have a research symposium where students are able to present wonderful talks. We had one student who kind of did this this project on Ramadan and fasting and what it's like. So she at her medical school, you know, had this informational talk for students and then allowed them to kind of participate in fasting for a day. They called it Fastathon. And throughout the day, you know, everybody, because it's kind of fasting together. And at the end of the day, they all broke their fast together. And they did surveys before and after. And it just showed, like, people were just so much more appreciative of what we go through and what it's like for us. And it was just helpful for them to know. Because a lot of times when I tell people I'm fasting, they're like, oh, like, not even water. And it's different, like people fast in different ways. So that was a wonderful informational opportunity for the students at her school to kind of connect with the Muslim students and really get to know them. So we have wonderful projects like that, or whether we have some students who are looking into alopecia regarding wearing a hijab and how traction alopecia might play into that and what we can do to kind of help, you know, solve that issue. Just a wonderful place. We always have wonderful talkers. Our first year, we had one of the founders of Sketchy come. We had Dr. Foz, who's a dermatologist in Michigan, also known as Dermy Doc, give one wonderful talk on like business and religion and medicine. So I think that's a wonderful place to kind of learn a little bit more for people who are interested.
What's it called again?
AMSA, so American Medical Muslim Student Association.
All right, we'll try to put a link in the show notes. And before we let you go, Ramla, we've talked a fair amount about what I can do as a doctor to try to deliver culturally competent care. You also have this different perspective as a medical student and a dermatology applicant. Are there things that you wish your teachers or mentors or the other students or applicants, do you have advice for them, I guess?
So advice and kind of just a little bit more, just as a student, I think it's important to remember that we're people too. A lot of times I feel myself just standing in a corner and I feel ignored. And I understand that everyone's busy and, you know, you're trying to get through the day and you have 20 patients to see, but it goes a long way just learning our name or asking us how our day is, or even when we step out of the room to kind of give us a 20-second rundown of what we saw. And in dermatology, it's difficult because if you're doing a skin check, you're looking at a million different things and it's difficult with the patient in there to point out everything. But when you step out, kind of just give a rundown of what you're looking for. Or once in a while, like ask the student to come over and look through the dermatoscope to look at a certain lesion. I had a wonderful attending who kind of brought me over and they were like, oh, look at this cherry angioma. Look at these lacunae, these, and then she lakes. And that was it. But when we walked out, we got to talk a little bit more about it. And it just really helps to kind of learn as you go. Because a lot of dermatology is seeing in books and studying. But just to kind of involve us if you can, if it's not too much work.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being here, and good luck on match day. It's right around the corner.
Good luck
on
the pick and go.
Thank you.
Well, listeners, we are not done with special guests for today. We've got one more, but before we introduce her, I do want to warn you all that the next 10 to 20 minutes, we'll be discussing some potentially uncomfortable or scary subject matter. human trafficking. So if you feel a little squeamish or you normally have kids hanging around, I'm not sure this is the best time to do that. But we'll be back with our normal stuff after our discussion with our guest, whom Michelle will introduce.
I am very excited to introduce my wonderful friend and incredible advocate for the specialty of dermatology as well as dermatologic patients, Shadi Karush. She is the Director of Community Health at the Department of Dermatology at Mass General, as well as an Associate Professor of Dermatology at Harvard Medical School. And she served in the past as Editor-in-Chief for Dialogues in Dermatology and currently is chairing the task force, the AAD Ad Hoc Task Force for Dermatologic Resources for the Intervention and Prevention of Human Trafficking. She's also served as an advocate at the national level to Congress. She's actually represented the AAD at Congress trying to discuss things including advocacy task forces for patients and drug development and transparency, drug pricing and transparency. So she's done some very important work for our patients and is here to talk to us about the very important topic of human trafficking and even more importantly, how we can learn more and do more about it and how we can prevent it or identify it. So Shadi, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. We're so happy to have you here.
Thank you so much, Michelle and Luke. Great to be here.
Can we start off with a simple question? I'm, you know, locked in my ivory tower of privilege. What is human trafficking?
You know, that's a great question that I think that we are all still learning more about. But the official definition of human trafficking, if we look at international organizations that have studied it, like the UN and the World Health Organization and the Department of Homeland Security, is that human trafficking is defined as the recruitment, transport, transfer, harboring, or receipt of people through force, fraud, or deception with the aim of exploiting them for profit. And this is thought to affect men, women, and children of all ages and all backgrounds who have been victims of this crime, which is occurring in every region of the world.
When I Googled it, a lot of the definitions said something like a form of modern day slavery.
Yeah, that's fair because it's exploiting people by force.
Well, I'd like to start just by being horrified that this is going on, and I'm sure you can further horrify me by telling me some statistics about it.
Yes, and I think that all of us that have encountered it as doctors have shared that horror, and it's been continual in my education about this. So in terms of the statistics that we know, the international organizations like the WHO and the UN report that over 27 million people worldwide annually are affected by human trafficking. And it's estimated that around a million people in the United States who or even US citizens could be affected by this. But I have to throw out the disclaimer that because of the hidden nature of these crimes, the true impact is probably unknown. We suspect that we're looking at the tip of an iceberg and that we know it's a criminal industry that generates about $150 billion per year, which by the way is surpassing profits from trade and in drugs and weapons. So, you know, it's huge. Suffice it to say that the problem is huge and that we're probably only aware of a portion of it.
Well, you wrote two fantastic articles about this topic, one of them in the International Journal of Women's Dermatology and another one in the JAD. And one of the very important points you made in the International Journal of Women's Dermatology publication is the fact that human trafficking doesn't imply that the person's crossing state lines. A person doesn't have to be moved to be trafficked. In fact, people can be trafficked in their own homes. And the real implication is that they're being forced to do something against their will without any kind of consent. You had some great points on helping identify patients who might be victims of sex trafficking or labor trafficking, which is another way that human beings can be virtually enslaved in this way. What are some of those signs that we can look out for as dermatologists?
Yeah, that's a really great point, Michelle. And I think that this is one of the lessons that's been really eye-opening for me as a doctor. But because before I took care of patients that were affected by this issue, I too may have thought of human trafficking in some sort of abstract sense of something that happens abroad, you know, in other countries, not in our own backyard here in the United States. But I can tell you that a lot of my patients were American young women, US citizens, who were, as you said, being trafficked even in their own neighborhoods. without the awareness of their communities. And so how this came on my radar is that I founded Mass General's pro bono tattoo removal program initially to help young people that were trying to get out of gangs. And I actually, you know, learned to do this and really was inspired to do this because when I was in my residency training in Texas, we had some wonderful attending physicians, Dr. Dennis Newton and Dr. Rebecca Ewer in Dallas, who ran this community program where residents like me from UT Southwestern used to go and volunteer with them every month. And it was a really wonderful experience where I learned about tattoo removal, about the science and the practice of tattoo removal through this wonderful community program where I was able to perform all the treatments under their supervision of a young man who had escaped from a gang and he wanted to get into the military and serve his country. And the last step was that he needed his visible tattoos to be removed. So that was an amazing experience. And so when I came up to Boston and joined Mass General, one of our community health centers was in a small town in Massachusetts that was the highest gangs per capita in all of New England. And so the way that dermatology could be helpful to the local primary care doctors and the local community organizations that were trying to help young people was to remove their tattoos. And in the process of doing this, the same stakeholders in the community started to refer to our clinic this emerging population of young women who had been forcibly branded with tattoos during their experience of human trafficking. And so as Luke pointed out, this is when the horror began for us because we had no idea about this issue and about the role as, that we as dermatologists could play. And so through the years of doing this work, we started to notice and compile patterns that we saw of their skin science. And so the paper that you mentioned, Michelle, that we first published in the International Journal of Dermatology now some years ago, was on the skin signs of human trafficking, which was a meta-analysis of everything that we could find in other literature, which was really scant in the medical community. Honestly, there was almost nothing, but we scoured the literature for everything that we could find. And then we combined that with our experiences of skin signs and published this review. And we continued to sort of gather data and we found that there were three categories emerging. And that was what I describe as the three I's. So the first I is infections. So these are largely sexually transmitted infections, but also could be infestations or other skin infections because of the poor living conditions that a lot of these people are subjected to. The second I is injury because of trauma to the skin, either in the setting of abuse of these patients, or we've later found out self-inflicted harm because a lot of these patients, because of their PTSD, have cutting behaviors and scars that might require other types of laser treatments, not tattoo removal, but you know, scar treatments via laser. And then the third category, the eye is what I refer to as imagery, that we started to notice that there were certain motifs in gang tattoos and trafficking related tattoos. And now you mentioned, you know, in our first paper that was about, you know, skin signs of trafficking, we identify that there's two major categories. There's labor trafficking and sex trafficking. In the labor trafficking, the skin signs that we would see were more the abuse and trauma to the skin and maybe infections because of poor conditions of living. But in the sex trafficking, that's where the tattoos started to become more relevant. And, you know, when I first started doing the work with local communities that were affected by gangs, one of our partnerships was with the New England Gang Unit, which was a specialized force in the police department that was working on the problem of gangs. And so police officers that had expertise came and lectured to our volunteers about recognizing gang tattoos. And there were symbols that I never would have even expected, you know, that the Roman numeral 18, for example, might have been a symbol for one of the gangs, and that the symbols in some regards could be highly specific and regional, but then there are certain motifs that were conserved. And we as dermatologists are good at picking up on patterns like that, like guns, violence, things like that. Versus in the sex trafficking tattoos, there were other motifs, ones of, believe it or not, romanticism or Valentine's, hearts, teddy bears, sometimes with the trafficker's name or initials involved with that, because these people might be trafficked by someone that they consider to be a boyfriend or a romantic interest sometimes. also motifs of currency. So dollar signs we've seen, or other things that imply transaction or ownership. Again, the name of the trafficker or the initials of the trafficker. And then also the location. For example, gang tattoos tend to be in really visible locations, the face, the neck, the arm, because there is an intention that the associates of the gang would identify this person, or the enemies of the gang may know who is part of their gang or who is not. In trafficking scenarios, we have seen some of the tattoos, again, in these highly visible locations overlapping with the gang tattoos, but then there's also tattoos in private areas like on the breast or in the genital region. And so these are the patterns that we've seen so far, but obviously there's a lot to learn.
Oh, absolutely. And unfortunately, traffickers, just like malignant neoplasms or infections, can adapt and change their behavior to get around our surveillance technique. So I think that, you know, being aware of these tools that are used by people who are trafficking other humans is very important. And the work that you did removing the tattoos is so important as well, because those tattoos can re-trap people who have escaped. They are actually people who have been re-trafficked because somebody else recognized the brand of, like, colleague is the wrong word, but an associate of somebody who is a trafficker, and they can actually become recaptured and re-trafficked. So removing those tattoos can be literally life-saving.
That's such a good point. And I really want to acknowledge our colleagues in the dermatology community that have also been doing this work. Because, you know, when I embarked on this journey to learn more about it, I found that there are many wonderful colleagues in the dermatology community who may not be doing this through organized programs like the one that I founded at Mass General, but who have been volunteering their time to do this. I mentioned Dr. Dennis Newton and Dr. Rebecca Ewer in Dallas, Texas. Another wonderful colleague, Dr. Paul Friedman, has been doing this in Houston, Texas. And as we know, you and I are both Texans. And so, you know, we're really, you know, this hits close to home for us that Texas is one of the highest density areas for human trafficking. And so, you know, I've been working with Paul Friedman in the work that he's doing, and in the work that he's trying to also involve other societies. For example, he was the president of the American Society of Laser Medicine and Surgery recently, and he has been mobilizing an entire core of volunteers in that society. I think they have 100 volunteers in their New Beginnings program. And now, through the American Society of Dermatologic Surgery, that organization is also mobilizing a list of volunteers. So it's really exciting to me that through my work chairing the AAD Task Force on Human Trafficking, that we are now partnering with all of these other dermatology societies, where each group, and the Women's Derm Society is also getting involved. So each group is finding their way to help, because this is a problem that's bigger than all of us. And it's now, I'm really happy to say, becoming a dermatology-wide initiative to help in this process.
So what do we do if we have a patient where we think this is an issue?
Well, that's a great question, Luke, and I'm happy to report that we are developing resources where dermatologists that may be encountering this problem for the first time can look to. So, for example, in the AAD Task Force on Human Trafficking, we've created a toolkit on the AAD website. So if you just Google AAD and trafficking, it should come up really quickly, where we've put together a lot of information that we've compiled so far on just background information on human trafficking, the skin signs. And we've also been working with expert psychologists who work with human trafficking survivors on understanding how to navigate the encounter with someone, you know, using the lens of trauma-informed care, like understanding, you know, how to speak to that person and how to encourage them to get help when they might be afraid. Or in many of these encounters, the trafficker may be actually close by or trying to dominate the visit. So, you know, we're really learning more about how to navigate that situation so that we can protect the patient's privacy while we're trying to help them, how to document that encounter in a way that protects privacy. So all of this information we're actually compiling, and the beginnings of it is already on this AAD toolkit. You know, another aspect of this is we're creating CME content, actually free CME content, with a wonderful woman who's become a mentor to me in this process. Her name is Professor Laura Lederer, and she was a professor at Georgetown Law And she has been an advisor to the State Department on human trafficking. She's the one that crafted the first legislation on human trafficking for the US, you know, now 20 years ago. And so we're working with experts like her and expert psychologists to create the first ever CME content for our field on this, which I'm happy to report is going to be available for free, also on the AAD website. So that's coming soon, stay tuned. And we've also created a database, a registry on the skin signs of human trafficking, which you can also find on the AAD website, where dermatologists can then report any skin signs that they've seen in an anonymous fashion. Like, it doesn't ask anything about patient identifying information. But say, for example, you encounter a patient that you're concerned might be trafficked. You can take a look at these resources ahead of time to prepare you, or step out of the room and quickly look at them if you know that's what you need to do. And then after the visit, you can document for our database anything that you feel are clinical pearls that you learned from that encounter about their skin signs or about anything else that would be relevant. And we're compiling this into a database to help inform our practice. So the CME resources, all of the content, and the database of the registry of the skin signs of human trafficking are actually going to be available in a smartphone app that we have created that is about to be released. You should be able to see it in the next couple of weeks. So it'll be available by the time of the AAD meeting. And that smartphone app is called STEAR, S-S-T-E-A-R, which stands for Skin Signs of Trafficking, Education, Advocacy, and Resources. So I would say that this smartphone app is your one-stop shop as a dermatologist who's trying to stay informed on this issue.
That's awesome. And I did the Googling. I Googled AAD and human trafficking, and the website came right up. So if you need to find those resources, it's just a Google search away. I think that this is such a valuable resource that we are offering through the AAD and that you are building through this platform. It will definitely, I think, help people recognize those signs of trafficking and help us as a community of dermatologists adapt, like the adaptive immune response to an infectious pathogen when it's trying to become resistant to antibiotics. We have to learn on the fly as these practices change and adapt over time.
That's a great analogy, Michelle. You're such a good science teacher.
So most of us are mandated reporters when it comes to suspicion of child abuse. So it seems if we have a human being who's 17 years of age or under who has some of these signs, we're mandated, you know, at least legally, we can discuss ethics and morals, I suppose, if we want, to get them to help, which often means the emergency room. It sounds like if you're dealing with an adult, it's a little bit more nuanced slash not straightforward.
Yeah, that's a great question, Luke. And for our pediatric dermatologists, they may be, as you said, used to having to report, because if a patient is less than 18 years of age, there are mandatory reporting laws. And there's a lot of information on state websites, like, for example, the state of Texas has, you know, a lot of information on their government website about human trafficking and also about mandatory reporting. And, you know, different states will have their mandates. But as you pointed out, if a person is older than 18 years of age, this becomes a more delicate and nuanced situation for us as doctors, because it's the patient's choice. And that's where really educating ourselves about trauma-informed care and learning from our colleagues, who are these expert psychologists that we're working with, who have made videos for us and are continuing to help with the content on our AAD website, really learning from them has helped me, and I think could be helpful to all of us in navigating these encounters. And one of the pearls that they've really emphasized to me in learning from the psychologist that I work with, for example, at Mass General, is that sometimes the intervention is not completely or effectively made in only one visit. And that, you know, helping a person who's in this very difficult and dire situation is really a process of helping them become safe, because they are traumatized, they're afraid of what might happen if they try to escape. And then sometimes they're lacking the resources to escape, right? So, you know, there's first the pearl of trauma-informed care, of understanding that building a relationship of trust with the patient so that they feel comfortable coming back to us may be the best thing that we can achieve in that first visit, because we may not be able to help them get out of their situation in just one visit. What we can do is be prepared to identify the skin signs and identify what's going on. And noticing those skin signs is what we're good at as dermatologists, because we notice things visually. And then that can prompt us to begin a conversation that might then begin building a relationship of trust that will help the patient come back. And then the second pearl that our psychologist friends have really taught me is that having relationships in place with resources that can help the patient will allow us to make a warm handoff. So for example, building a relationship with the social workers in your health system or in your community, or knowing your local shelters or local legal aid organizations, because sometimes these traffickers will scare the patient, into thinking that they're not going to be able to survive, or sometimes they've been forced into petty crimes, and so they actually flee from law enforcement. So really having already in place these relationships with these interdisciplinary teams of people that will help the patient will allow us to say, you know, I'm going to put you in touch with my friend and colleague who is a social worker who can help someone in your situation. And she's helped other people in this situation. And so being able to know your resources will allow you to then perform that warm handoff.
Absolutely. I think that is so important to know your network of support. There's a special kind of nurse training that's also helpful if you have access to it, something called a SANE nurse, which is a sexual assault nurse. I think expert is the E part. And these are nurses that have, nurse examiner, sexual assault nurse examiner. And so these are nurses that have special training to work with victims of sexual assault. They have special training not only in how to recognize what may have happened to a person, but also how to interact with them to avoid re-traumatization or activating any kind of panic responses. And that resource provision that you mentioned, Shadi, is so important, because you're absolutely right. The traffickers will trap their victims by all sorts of clever means, including keeping the person's identification so they don't have a driver's license that they're in possession of anymore. The trafficker keeps that, so the person can't even go apply for any help or identify themselves properly. They might not have any control over their own finances. People can really be trapped in a very hopeless kind of way in these circumstances. And so identifying those resources and having a plan kind of before you need that access is a really good strategy.
Yes, that's a great point, Michelle. And that's the whole message that we're trying to convey, is that, you know, educating ourselves promotes this kind of preparedness, and relationship building with these interdisciplinary teams, as you mentioned, the sexual assault nurse examiners, psychologists, the social workers, the shelters, helps us be prepared. This is all about capacity building, right? And some people have asked me, why is this so important in the medical community? And something that I learned from Professor Laura Lederer, the law professor and the advisor to the State Department, who has now become an advisor to our AAD task force, is that she published really what was the landmark paper on the health of human trafficking survivors in 2014. It was in the Annals of Health Law. So it was interesting that when I, as a doctor, was trying to just advocate for my patients and become educated on this issue, the best paper that I found was not in the medical literature. It was actually published by a law professor. And, you know, in this paper, she and her team went into 100 different shelters. I mean, they went into many different shelters throughout the country and interviewed over 100 patients. And what they learned is that 88% of the people that they spoke with reported that they had passed through the healthcare system while they were being actively exploited and gone unrecognized. Okay, so when we learned that, we realized that the medical visit is the important key point of contact and the opportunity for intervention. You know, and Professor Lederer says this, and also our contacts in law enforcement, that people that are being trafficked, as we said, for various reasons, they actually avoid law enforcement. They may hide from law enforcement, but at some point they seek healthcare. And so Professor Lederer is the first person to say, and she said this to our AAD task force on trafficking, she has said that the medical community are really the first responders on this issue. And so that's why it's really important that we do this capacity building and we build preparedness in the medical workforce so that we're aware of this issue, we're aware how to recognize it and how to navigate these encounters and how to get people helpful resources.
And I think working with your local county medical society is a wonderful way to do this. When I I was a couple of years back, I was president of our county medical society in Lubbock, and we put together a like task force for sex trafficking victims that actually gave a protocol to people to follow with, you know, this is where your SANE nurses are. This is how you get a hold of them. This is how you get emergency provision of contraception. These are the shelters that have safe places for people who need to be kept in a way that other people can't find them. And I think that that kind of community work can also set the stage for success and intervening in a person's, you know, entrapment through the sex trafficking process. So I'm so grateful for the attention you're bringing to this and for the resources that you're building. If there's one thing that you could have our viewers remember about sex trafficking as they're going into their daily practice, what would it be?
I would say that everything that we've learned from surveying the medical community thus far indicates that we don't have enough awareness about it. And so I think that just taking advantage of the resources that are out there, which, you know, thankfully people like you all are doing through raising awareness on your podcast, I think that the first step is becoming aware that this is going on in our communities. And the second step is becoming aware of our resources, checking out the AAD Trafficking Toolkit website, downloading the app, and continuing the discourse. And that's where we begin.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for everything you do, Shadi. You are a powerhouse and a wonderful advocate for our patients and our specialty. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Heavy stuff. I don't want to talk about human trafficking anymore. I want to talk about sun protection. That's a lot easier for me to spend brain power thinking about. So this next article is about how sun protection does not weaken your bones. I believe this one came from CertLink and is from JAMA Dermatology. The title is Association of Sun Protective Behaviors with Bone Mineral Density and Osteoporotic Bone Fractures in U.S. Adults. Authors include Mohsen Faraday, Julio Sartori Vallinotti, and Megha Tollefson. So you might have some patients who like the sun. They want to hang out in the sun. And if you're like, hey, you should put sun protection on your skin and wear hats and stuff, they might say, oh, come on, the sun is good for my bones. Perhaps because of this vitamin D thing. Well, this study says, don't worry. Sun protective habits were not associated with an increased risk of the hard outcomes. Get it? Like osteoporotic fracture and decreased bone density.
I like it.
So this study used data from something called the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, NHANES, NHANES, I suppose.
Oh, yeah,
which apparently happens every 2 years. You familiar with the NHANES?
Yeah, that's used for a lot of sort of population-based research and has kind of brought us some like population-based data about different health behaviors and how it can affect outcomes. It specifically is to, I think, look at nutritional status and things that affect people's health around that space.
And I think Kesha has a song about it, right? Doesn't she say, let me see them NHANES?
I mean, you know, She's a quite a dynamic woman. She could be doing nutritional research. I'm not sure. She does break, brush her teeth with a bottle of Jack, which I couldn't recommend, but it could have antiseptic properties. Who knows?
Well, don't Jack and tan. So this NHANES thing, as you say, interviews and physical exams of U.S. adults. And this particular study uses data from the 2017-2018 NHANES survey, which is like the earliest available because it takes them some time to like crunch all the numbers and make them available. So about 3,400 participants completed the dermatology portion of the interview and could be included in this study. And then they got their bone mineral density was determined with a DEXA machine, which I think is just like a fancy X-ray, though. Mm-hmm. I'm sure PCPs, et cetera, know a lot more about this, but you're nodding knowledgeably. And history of osteoporotic fracture in these participants was determined by asking them if they have ever been told they have a fractured spine, wrist, or hip. And then sun protective habits were included in the interview and included using sunscreen on, quote, very sunny days, as well as staying in the shade and wearing long sleeves. There was a lot of multivariate analysis to control for various confounders, you know, like gender and age and physical activity. So listeners, just don't worry about those. So none of the sun protective behaviors was associated with an increased risk of fracture, and staying in the shade was and staying in the shade was associated with a decreased risk of spine fracture, perhaps because these are just cautious individuals. No, no, you go cliff diving. I'm going to stay here under this palm tree. Diminished bone mineral density of the spine was potentially associated with moderate sunscreen use. There was a minus 0.35 effect on the bone mineral density when compared to like a baseline of one. But this was mostly seen in older individuals, and even if it were true, the authors say it would be much less relevant than other important issues such as nutrition and physical activity. And again, fracture was not increased. So that's the story. So good news overall. Would this data actually convince anyone to change their habits? I will admit that human nature's, like my studies of human nature, has made me rather skeptical. People just sort of do what they want to do, and then they make up reasons why they do it. And if you give them some other reason why they shouldn't, then they'll just make up some other reason to do what they want to do. But perhaps there's some people out there where this could move the needle, and it's just nice to have this data. Other interesting stuff that came out of this article, a little bit less optimistic. Only about half of respondents used any sun protective measures, and almost no one used more than one. So we're not doing great with our education. Though maybe it's not our fault. Maybe it's just human nature. People do what they want to do, and then they make up reasons for it. There's a kind of there's a book about this, by the way. It's called Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And the first half of the book, it's by a moral psychologist, talks about how the human brain can be thought of as using the metaphor of an elephant and a rider. And the elephant just decides where it wants to go. I mean, it's big and strong. The rider's not going to do anything. He's just hanging out on top. But his job is to, like, justify what the elephant's doing. So he also uses the metaphor of the elephant's, like, the PR guy or your lawyer or something like that. Just make up reasons why you do what you want to do. I mean, it was fairly convincing. And it, I mean, it applies to all of us. I do what I want to do, and then I make up reasons for it, I suppose. Anywho, no one, almost no one used more than one sun protective measure, though most more people said they stayed in the shade than those who said they used sunscreen than those who said they wore long sleeves. These are similar to the results from the NHANES 2011 to 2014 data. So again, we could do better educating our public. Some good news about vitamin D. Studies from 2017 and 2019 showed that sunscreen does not negatively impact your vitamin D level. We actually discussed one of these articles back in episode 3. Initially, though, perhaps this was a reasonable concern because the wavelength for vitamin D photosynthesis, pimping bell, are you listening, is in the carcinogenic UVB range, which is 290 to 320 nanometers. So vitamin D is sort of a surrogate for the outcomes we really care about, like fracture looks fine, and then a fracture itself looks fine. One other bit, in case you wondered, well, who is it who uses these sun protective behaviors? Well, they say U.S. adults practicing an increasing number of sun protective behaviors were more likely to be older, female, be from Mexican American or Asian descents.
Interesting.
Educated at college level or above, be born abroad, be non-smokers, engage in less intense physical activity, experience sunburns, spend fewer minutes outdoors, and have some sun sensitivity and lower BMI scores.
Interesting. Lower BMI in general is associated with lower bone density. So that could potentially be a kind of confounding factor there. But that is interesting. I think that the prevalence of people born in other countries might reflect the general disparity with which skin color can be perceived in this country versus other countries. The U.S. Tends to have sort of the beach blonde with the beautiful tan as an ideal of beauty. But in many countries around the world, the ideal of beauty is actually lighter colored skin. In fact, one of the most heavily selling cosmetics in the entire world is something called Fair and Lovely, which is usually a hydroquinone-containing topical that's used to bleach skin. And so that might have some relevance to the change in sunscreen use for people born outside the country. That's interesting.
Yeah, I was thinking sort of similar issues. You see photographs from Korea, for example, of everyone with sort of their sun parasols and their masks, even during non-pandemic times, to protect their skin. So we can learn something from that. Mm-hmm. Bring back the sun parasols.
I think parasols are beautiful. And it's got a good name, parasol, like it's for the sun. It's just fabulous, you know. Parapluie would be the one we would call an umbrella in French. The interesting point about the vitamin D synthesis and its use as a justification for sun exposure, I think, is a point of nuance for dermatologists to understand and educate their patients for. Most tanning beds don't have enough UVB in them to make any vitamin D at all. And the reason for that is that if you're a good business person and you have a product that produces a result like a tan, and you have a potential adverse outcome that could come along with that, like a sunburn, if you can remove the possibility for the adverse outcome while still being able to produce the desired outcome, you're going to do that. So most tanning beds are UVA almost exclusively, with only a very small amount, if any, of UVB, but it's only the UVB wavelengths that make vitamin D. And a lot of the sales pitches that are done in tanning salons include the sort of idea that you're helping your body stay healthy by making vitamin D. But if you are in a tanning salon where you're using tanning beds that don't have any risk of sunburn because they don't have any UVB rays, you aren't making any vitamin D. And so I do try to educate my patients that are tanners about the fact that unless they have a bed that has both wavelengths of UVA and UVB, that they're not actually going to be making any significant vitamin D with that behavior.
Well, that is all the time we have for today. So thanks so much for joining us, listeners. And thanks, of course, to our institutions. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. And thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. Friends, remember about the Integrative Dermatology Symposium, which is occurring in September in Texas. And remember, you can use code DERMASPHERE for a discount on your registration. Thanks to all the members of Team Dermasphere who keep this podcast moving along behind the scenes. They include Morgan Dykman, Guy Kusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, Angie Wong, Laura Dela Cruz, Jordan Easterling, Austin Callister, Nicole Babkowski, Lior Lavin, and Justin Lyon. Among other things, they help maintain our website. You can find us at dermaspherepodcast.com, which also has links to all of the original articles, our entire archive, and ways to reach out to us. Other ways to reach out to us include X, Instagram, and Facebook. And friends, if you feel that this podcast has brought some entertainment or other value to your life and you would like to give back, we are welcome to accept your donations at uofuhealth.org/dermasphere. You can also find some of our content on YouTube and ViewMedi, which are both video platforms. And you can hang out with Michelle and I either personally or virtually. Virtually through the University of Utah Dermatology Echo sessions, which occur once monthly. And personally at the AAD. We're both going to be there. We're both hosting this Resident Jeopardy thing. We also are giving other talks. Michelle's giving like, I don't know, 80 of them. I'm doing like one or two. And we'll be trying to walk around with our Dermasphere pins pinned prominently to our chests and backpacks. So feel free to come and say hello. That is all for today, friends. We will see you again in 2 weeks. Oh, wait, I forgot to remind us all what we learned today. So today we learned about culturally competent care. We learned about human trafficking. And we learned that sun protective behaviors do not increase your risk of fracture. So keep that in mind for the next 2 weeks when we'll talk again.